When CSD, I guess, acquiesced to the mother's desire and to what seemed to be the best situation, was it ever discussed in terms of whether or not this care was going to be temporary, or was it assumed that this was going to be until he reached...
That was just left. We had a long state.
And if I understood your statements correctly, do you receive any compensation for this care that you're providing, or are you just doing this?
Mike was receiving Social Security. We didn't receive any. For the first year, my mother sent out some we didn't receive any compensation after we were out of his expense. Mike started receiving Social Security. And at that point, we started receiving support.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that the Social Security he was receiving was from his stepfather, right, who didn't have the standing in the court to get the custody the first time around. He lived with us for 3.5 years, and the boy is now 14, and he's in this is his 11th move, and he's looking to at least two more before he's, well, by the time he's 15, he'll have at least one more with another one scheduled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further questions? Representative Kopetsky?
Thank you. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear your answer in terms of support. Was there some sort of parental support being provided?
The first year that the boy was with us, his mother sent us $60 or $62 a month. After that, he was we received support from both of his parents and a Social Security money from his stepfather.
And how long did that continue?
The whole time he was with us, 3.5 years.
After the first year was out.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also, are you in any kind of contact with him?
Yes.
With the boy?
We were encouraged by Children's Services to continue staying in contact with him and visit him.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Grace Jackson.
My name is Grace Jackson, and I testified before and regarding grandparents' rights. Mine is very short. The lady that was here before this couple, many of her problems have been our problems. Our grandson wants to live with my husband and with me, and for us to have custody. His attorney feels neither parental home is right for him. A child psychologist he has been seeing recommends custody for us as grandparents because of his close bond with us. He has been talking lately of running away from the home he is in now. They have tried everything in the book and out of the book to keep him from us. He is forbidden to write us or to phone us unless they are involved in it. He called us without permission and told us repeatedly how much he loved us and how much he wanted to be with us. However, because grandparents have very little legal standing with the court, we have been repeatedly told that it's probably not possible. It would seem that the person most affected, the child, has little voice in the matter because of the lack of legal standing for others who may be able to give the child a greater sense of stability and security. I would strongly urge the passing of this bill to help us and others to have our day in court, and that's all we really want. We want our day in court.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Thanks for being so patient. Here we have Kay Aline.
Yeah. presenting supplements, a letter which I recently wrote to all of the members of the House Judiciary, which you may or may not have received and read. I'm testifying as a non-traditional parent and coming from a non-traditional family, both because of an interracial family situation and a non-married family situation. Unfortunately, our family is still in crisis, and it's very difficult to be before you today. Much of what Trinka Darter has presented is similar to my situation, except that she has the legality of step-parenthood, which still is not recognized by the courts. I do not have that legality, though I did, in fact, serve in the role of a step-parent for over 5 years for children that I consider to be my own. I am asking also that cases such as mine, and these that you've heard, be allowed to come before someone who can listen to those who are unrepresented, such as myself. This has been, and obviously is, very traumatic for the children and certainly for their father and for myself, as divorce always is. But because we're not technically termed a divorce, we cannot bring these issues before CSD, before a juvenile court, before any mediated party. And in fact, it gives their father unlimited power to interfere with our continued contact, because of the fact that he is the only legally recognized parent. He has custody of the children from a previous divorce, at which time he received custody because of the birth mother's history of mental illness. At that time, strong bonding occurred between the children and myself, which has endured to this point. We separated last summer when he took the children to Barbados in the West Indies. The oldest daughter lasted 10 days before she was on a plane and returned home to me. Within 3 months, I went to Barbados to pick up the younger daughter. Neither of the children were able to manage emotionally the separation from me as their psychological parent. That term has come up before. Dr. Richard Lazare, who has been a family psychologist for all of those concerned in our case over the past number of years, has stated to me that he felt that the validity of this term must be recognized in the courts because it exists in the reality of our family lives. I understood that there was much concern about just anyone coming in and trying to take over custody of children. In fact, these children did remain in my custody while their father continued his sabbatical in the West Indies. At the time that he returned, he was very threatened by the fact that they did not want to return to live with him. They wished to remain in my care because of the emotional nurturing and support and stability that I had provided them over a very difficult 6 years of time that we existed as a family. He became physically violent in their presence, called the police, invoked his custody papers, which ceased any rational and reasonable continuation of discussion of the children's best interests, their rights, and their welfare. He removed them to a one-bedroom apartment where they are now living with him. He's extremely unstable at this time, what I'd like to attribute to a male midlife crisis. I'm present company here, may or may not accept that terminology. Nevertheless,
sure to the two
I encouraged continuity of contact between the children and their father. I have supported at great cost to myself continuity of contact between the children and their birth mother, who, because of her mental illness, has been in and out of institutions and has been on and off medication, has been between here and Washington, D.C., and back. She was so disturbed by his going to Barbados with the children and taking them from me that she left with nothing but a purse and got on an airplane and returned here, called me in the middle of the night, and I was able eventually to return her to the care of Clackamas County Mental Health, where she's now fortunately been stabilized. She has visitation privileges with these children, which I do not have. I support her right to visitation, but at this point, these children are trying to see me every day, and their father is so threatened by their bonds with me that he is refusing to allow that continuity of contact. And I would like this bill to pass so that we as a family maybe go before someone who could hear all sides and make some decisions about what's in the best interest of these children.
Okay, we have your written comments, your letter, as well as a couple letters apparently signed by the father,
yes,
which I think purported to give you certain rights or responsibilities. I wasn't sure, and I may have missed this. Have you had the children within your physical custody for any extended period of time since the departure for Barbados?
Yes, from the, as I said, he was gone 10 days when the oldest daughter returned, so she was with me from September 1st until the middle of March when he invoked the custody papers. The younger girl, who was 9, was with me from December 10th when I went to Barbados to pick her up until this same date in March when he called the police. And in essence, the children were confronted with the reality of male power, police power and brute force, because first their father got out his fists and then he called the police. And the policeman looked at the papers and said, me, as their mother, that they were crying to leave with, had to go. And it was of no legal concern to the policemen as to who they were had been living with, who'd been caring for them, who they wanted to continue living with. It was a piece of paper that said he had custody from 6 years ago. And because we cannot go to court and make a new agreement, I do not even have visitation rights, which is the minimum that I'm.
Do you know if the children, are they still in Oregon?
Did
you
yes. Say? Yes. They are currently in our community.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much. That concludes, I believe, the list of those who had signed up and asked to testify. Are there any others who are here who didn't sign up or who haven't had a chance to testify yet on 2460? Okay, thank you all very much. I would like to be able to begin our work session on 2638. We've got a lot of materials. Our problem, however, is that we don't have a quorum for purposes of transacting business. Representatives Miller and Phillips have both advised me that they have been called to an audience with the governor. I'm not sure how long. I know Representative Kopetsky. I haven't been asked yet either.
They really rub it in when they do it, when they schedule them during the day, you know?
The person,
they can do it in the morning.
The person could take it personally, but...
I heard him working out on the deck there a couple weeks ago, you know?
Funny thing.
I'd come down and help him.
I guess, why don't we go ahead and at least review the materials that are before us. Council, if you would share with us, I know that you've been working with interested parties to try to prepare a, quote, neutral draft that purports to represent what it is that the Supreme Court has suggested we ought to do so that our statute conforms to the holding in that Supreme Court decision. And I know there are others who may have a different opinion in terms of how that neutral draft should be prepared, and I understand there may be a question in light of a situation which occurred in the city of Portland within the past 10 days as to what may be deadly force and whether or not we're speaking strictly of deadly weapons or we're speaking of deadly force of another character as well. So, Council, if you want to review these materials, I know you prepared a memo to our committee and we have a couple drafts before us. If you could review those briefly, then I think we'll ask those who've been working to find the appropriate language to perhaps come up together before the witness table, and hopefully we'll be rejoined by another member of the committee and we can actually go into work session. I think if there's anyone staying here on the jury bills, it's not likely that we're going to get the work session on those bills today, but we will try to reschedule those within a brief and appropriate period of time. There were a couple of amendments proposed today, and I think members would like an opportunity to reflect upon those amendments before taking final action. Council?
All right. I think you'll find in the memo that there are notes from the meeting that was held on Friday. We had 14 people were present, and we had members of the state police, the Portland police, peace officers. We had a sheriff from Lane County and another sheriff present. And we discussed the amendments that were drawn up by Mr. Gruber at my request, at the request of the chair, which are labeled 429 LC amendments. All right? And these are amendments that establish a standard based upon what Mr. Gruber believed to be the Supreme Court case's reasoning. All right. We discussed those in that meeting, and we also discussed a second set of amendments, which I don't believe are marked, but it says House Bill 2638. It looks like this. These were prepared by the Department of Justice. Mr. Fussner was at the meeting as representing the Department of Justice, presented these amendments, and the group discussed both of them. Most of the people there agreed that they thought the language drawn up by the Department of Justice was simpler and clearer for them to understand, and preferred that language to the language drafted by legislative counsel. I've had a chance to study both of them, and in the memo that I put out, I told you there are three different written standards that you have to consider. The first one is the standard that the Supreme Court used, which is, should the standard for using deadly force be based upon probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a threat of serious physical harm either to the officer or to others, or that there is probable cause to believe the suspect has committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious physical harm. That was the language taken out of the Supreme Court case. The second standard is suggested by the Department of Justice, which sets a standard of reasonable belief of what is necessary to defend the officer or another person from what the officer believes to be the infliction or threatened infliction of serious physical injury, as the Department of Justice suggests. Now, one thing I want to tell you is that both Legislative Council and Department of Justice tried to work with the Oregon statutes and tried to work with existing language and come up with language that would fit into those statutes. Our statute, I don't believe, really is completely in sync with the United States Supreme Court's decision. We say reasonable belief, they talk about probable cause. And when to use probable cause is slightly different from what we set up as standards here in Oregon. But I would advise you that the memo prepared by the Department of Justice dated April 10th, 1985, that you received at the last time is an excellent memo that lays out all the issues and all the Oregon statutes and how they interact. And I thought their analysis was excellent in terms of what the Supreme Court case says. However, they are taking a position that the committee ought to consider reasonable belief as is necessary as a standard for when to use deadly force rather than probable cause to believe. Mr. Gruber, on the other hand, tried to meet the middle ground, I think, where he suggested that an officer in in attempting to use deadly force, making arrest or prevent the escape of a person, the officer had to reasonably believe the use of such force is necessary to arrest the person or prevent the escape of an arrested person from custody, then the officer has to have probable cause to believe the person has committed a crime or is otherwise lawfully subject to arrest. So in a sense, he created sort of a double standard, reasonable belief and then probable cause. Those are the, at least right now, the three written materials before you for a decision. And of course, you as a committee can decide to go with any one of them or a combination of them. It is up to you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Phillips, we've just reviewed a couple of the options. The Long Amendment is one that Mr. Gruber prepared. It's noted as the LC Amendments. And Council, the other hand gross version bill, that was
Department of Justice.
Submitted by the Department of Justice. And apparently Mr. Gruber also took a somewhat different tack in terms of the sections he chose or thought it was appropriate to amend. I don't know if Mr. Gruber is available to answer questions. Is he aware, or did he indicate?
He was not aware of this. He did. He was very helpful at the meeting on Friday because he had to answer all the questions and defend the language that he had drafted at that meeting, and he was asked a number of questions. However, despite the fact that he explained it to everybody and tried to point out what point he was trying to make, where he was coming from, that group did not agree with it and preferred the Department of Justice's language. I've looked at the Department of Justice's language, and having looked at all the statutes, if the committee preferred that, it seems to me you could still, and preferred this actual language itself, but preferred the standard of probable cause, you can plug in probable cause into this language that's been provided by the Department of Justice.
Okay.
And I would remind you that there is a slight distinction between reasonably believe and probable cause being a higher standard to act on than reasonable belief.
Okay, Representative Hill.
For counsel. Counsel, why, given the Supreme Court standard was probable cause, what was the rationale for Department of Justice going to reasonable?
Well, I'll take a stab at that, and then if I do injustice.
Why don't we invite some of the participants maybe to assist, or counsel, if you want to paraphrase it, but we do have, I guess, the best source of information here also.
Well, let me just say one thing.
Yeah, Mr. Collins was here. I don't know if the representative of the DAs is still here. Or
Mr.
Collins. Yeah, great.
Oregon historically has had a statute that says that peace officers can use deadly force when they reasonably believe that such force is necessary, and then it has listed a specific set of crimes that have been committed where you could use deadly force. And I think that the Department of Justice tried to be consistent with the historical standard that we've set in the state and use reasonably believe that such force is necessary to be in sync with our statutes. But the question is whether that standard actually meets what the Supreme Court set in its recent case.
Okay, let me, I know Mr. Hall wishes to make a couple of comments. And I guess, Mike, why don't I ask you if you could now maybe to state your concerns or matters which you think we ought to consider. And I ask you to do that now because I want the folks who are here to have the benefit of your comments before they come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Committee, I'm not here as an expert on this, but I did receive a frantic call from part of the community in Portland today saying, please go over there and see what they're doing with deadly force. We're worried. Words to that effect and longer. And it does indeed relate to the whole question of the incident that occurred in Portland. And all I can say at this point is whether or not the definition of deadly force, as I see it in the ORS 161.015, is indeed adequate in Section 3 there, or shouldn't say something about with or without the use of an instrument, so that that's 161.015 subsection 3, after the word physical force, with or without the use of an instrument, something like that would address the issue, I think, that was called to my attention this morning. I just lay it before you as an issue that is a concern to a very significant community in Portland that is wrestling with this issue.
Okay. I don't pretend to know the statute well enough to know if this has been presented for any kind of interpretation or decision at the appellate level. I would guess that in the context of this bill, we have tended to talk about firearms and weapons and their use in terms of deadly force, but obviously there are circumstances in which deadly force can occur
with your hands.
One's hands.
So I said without an instrument to imply the physicalness of it in terms of the human body. That may not be appropriate language, it's all I can think of at the moment. But the concern was genuine. And I said I would relay the concern to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Hall? If not, thank you, Mike. Counsel, I know there were questions, or we had Mr. Frost testify at one of our earlier hearings, district attorney from Linn County, and he expressed the concern that if we were to make changes, or at least those changes in the original bill, or possibly changes suggested by the Supreme Court decision, it was his concern that a citizen making a citizen's arrest would have greater authority than police officers making an arrest in similar circumstances. Was that discussed at all? Or?
Yes, it was discussed. I mean, it was the concern of several people there that in passing the bill as originally written, that it would create a situation where police officers would have less, would be able to use deadly force less than the average citizen, and that it would be more restrictive for a police officer to use it than a citizen. Perhaps, in thinking about that issue, perhaps this might be useful to the committee. The average citizen doesn't have any kind of training, as far as I know, usually, on how to use deadly force. And they can use deadly force in a situation where, as I understand it, where someone comes into their home and threatens them. And at that point, they have a right to use deadly force. And that's usually the situation, as I understand it, that it's limited to unless you're being attacked and it's a question of self-defense and other circumstances. On the other hand, police officers have a great deal of training on what kind of force to use, and they have a lot of training in terms of the law and what the limitations are and the extent of their authority to use deadly force. And so I guess what I'm suggesting to the committee is that the argument that private citizens would have more opportunity to use deadly physical force than a police officer is not really true, because private citizens can only use it in extremely limited situations where their life is threatened or they're in their home. And so I think perhaps that argument isn't as strong and compelling an argument as it might first appear when you hear it.
Okay, I note that, you know, just reviewing these statutes briefly, the whole structure seems predicated upon reasonable belief, and that's civilian as well as law enforcement. And I guess, for one, if we change the standard from reasonable belief to probable cause, I guess we need to re-examine the rest of the statutes and decide if they're needs to be a different policy, if we want a different standard for civilians versus law enforcement, and whether that standard perhaps it ought to be throughout, we change reasonable belief to probable cause. I haven't heard many people suggesting that, and I don't know if we should have a different standard for law enforcement as opposed to civilians. A civilian only has to reasonably believe something, but an officer has to have probable cause. I'm not sure how much of a distinction there is out on the street in real life. I think there is a distinction, but that gets a little blurred other than in the court of law. Parties may attempt to interpret it in light of something that's already happened, and that's always difficult. Counsel?
As I recall, my conversation with Frank Gruber about this case and the different standards, I believe I recall that he said that you need probable cause to arrest, and we're talking about, factually, we're talking about an arrest situation, and that it's that you need probable cause on a statutory basis in order to arrest. So it wouldn't be out of sync with the factual situation. If you're in arrest, you need probable cause, and it would fit in at that point. And I don't know the historical reason why we have two different standards. Why you have to have probable cause to arrest, but you only need to use reasonable. You only have to reasonably believe that force is necessary to use deadly force in a situation where you are preventing the escape of a person from custody.
Can I ask counsel a question?
Yes, Representative.